Hi, and welcome back to our community. I'm Candace Michelle, and I'm joined again today by Beth Barker Hidalgo from the Curry Homeless Coalition and Diana Cooper from the Brookings Homeless Task Force, soon to become Brookings Core Response. Welcome back to the show, my friends. It's nice. I really do. I feel like we are becoming friends. I like that. I like that. The more friends, the better, right?
Mm-hmm. Especially right now.
Exactly. So let's start with you, Beth. Can you explain a little bit what the Curry Homeless Coalition's purpose is, like how it got started, when it got started, what it does? You know, just kind of give us a primer.
Sure.
On that.
Sure. The Curry County Homeless Coalition was established as a nonprofit May 25th, 2007. There was a board, and at the time, I believe it was around the time when, I think at the national level, there was a call for counties and cities and states to develop plans to end homelessness. And so that was, I think, the impetus of the creation of the Homeless Coalition. Mm-hmm. There just didn't seem to be, there was a plan developed, a 10-year plan to end homelessness, and at the county level. And I'm not, I think there was a census done, an unofficial point in time, kind of a local census done. I believe they did it in the middle of summer, which makes more sense for us because that's when we do have a high population on the coast often, typically in a typical year, not a pandemic year.
And so all bets are off if you've got a pandemic going on, right?
Yeah. But there wasn't political will, is my understanding. You know, and I didn't live here then. I didn't move here till January of 2012. So January 2012, I come along and I get to know then Commissioner Brown was commissioner, I believe, in 2015.
Susan Brown.
Yeah. And she dusted off the 10-year plan to end homelessness, which is now, I don't know, 8-9 years old. Mm. And there had not,
okay.
From what I
don't even know what to say about that, yeah. But okay.
But yeah. There was really a focus at that time on inclusion of runaway homeless youth.
Mm.
And foster, there was a strong focus on foster care and the impacts on homelessness. You know, 45% of male homeless have come out of our foster care system.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
45%.
Yeah. Nationwide.
Wow.
That's the statistic, is that 45% of males, single males, have come out of our foster care system. So that doesn't speak well to the foster care system necessarily.
Not particularly.
But, there's a lot of issues there, abandonment and
right.
Who knows what kids have gone through before they've gone into care. So at any rate, there was a focus on youth, and the plan was revised at that time in I think, 2014-15. Susan, Commissioner Brown worked on revision of the plan, added the homeless youth component, as she and Jerry Alleman Honeycutt, who is now, I think, Jerry Tuttle. But anyway, they were kind of the spearheads of the board. Jim Johnson was on the board. Mary Rowe, I believe, served on the board at one time or another. And but now we're fast forward into 2015. The plan has been revised, and it caught the attention of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. A subsidiary of Robert Wood Johnson granted the coalition a $10,000 grant to do some community building around homelessness. And then All Care kicked in another $1,000. And so out of that money, we made brochures, trifold. We got some brochures made up. We had business cards made up. We also hired a facilitator and had a workshop at Pistol River Friendship Hall. And we I had about 35 or so people, key community members that came together and developed a work plan for focus areas of homeless portals is what we called them, which are basically day use or drop-in centers, and homeless youth and housing were the three focus areas of the coalition. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to a community health assessment, community health improvement plan, and it was obvious that we had some serious gaps in Central Korea in terms of services. So our systems of care, again, that are criminal justice and healthcare systems, that would discharge people into the community, often have no support or safety net or anything. So we were approached by, again, a funder who said, you know, if you could stand up a one-stop here in Gold Beach, you know, we can help you with that. And we brought our partners together. And we ran the Southern Oregon Coast Resource Center for 2 years. And then our lease was not renewed by the county. The county was nice enough to donate 6 months of our rent so that we could put some money together and get into another location. We wanted to buy a group home in Gold Beach. We were focusing on that during the 2019-2020. And it just didn't, we couldn't get the funding together to buy the group home here in Gold Beach to use as a transitional housing project. And so we decided to go mobile. And now we're in a bus. I'm at the SDA Church on 3rd Street in Gold Beach on Tuesdays from 10 to 2, and I'm down at the Gold Beach Community Center 10 to 2. I still have, I think I mentioned last week, showers are the one thing that we're really not able to replicate with our mobile program, and it's the one thing that people need the most, I think, or want the most anyway.
And what do you do with the mobile program? What are the food. Things that are available?
We have hot food. We purchase food from our Meals on Wheels program. So we have food. I brew a pot of coffee in the morning before I go out, and I've got an AirPod and, you know, sugar creamer cups. We have all the applications that we had in the building. So Lifeline, subsidized housing, Housing Choice Vouchers, Section 8 applications, ORCA, COVID relief applications through Community Action right now, rent relief. And they don't have to necessarily meet me at the bus Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 10 to 2. I mean, our phone number is 541-425-0426. And our email is curryhomelesscoalition@gmail.com. People can call or email. And, Mondays and Fridays are my admin office days, writing grants, doing the books, doing, you know, creating policies, doing the back behind the scenes stuff. So, we have a strong board. Melissa Hendrickson is our chair. She is with SCBEC, South Coast Business Employment Council. I'm happy for her. She just got interim director of the division. She is an employment specialist, career navigator, and helps. We refer to her a lot for folks that are looking for work. We also have Jan Barker. Her subject matter expertise is addictions. She also runs the domestic violence intervention program here in Curry County. We have got a strong, Teresa Lawson, who's with Talawa Tribe. She's a strong finance background. Is on our board. Mm-hmm. Jim Johnson, who's been serving the unsheltered or unstably housed since, I don't know, forever. Forever. He used to work in the, he was pivotal in the response to the AIDS epidemic. In Southern California, and he and others worked together to stand up the very first hospice program for AIDS in the country.
Nice.
For AIDS patients. And so Jim has had his heart has been with folks that struggle and unstably housed and or have mental illness. And, you know, he sits in a courtroom for some of our clients. He's there for some of our clients every single time they have court. So we have folks on our board that are representative of the need in the community.
Good.
We are all very passionate about helping to lift our community.
Good. Thank you. That is excellent information. And hopefully we've got a couple of people out there whose ears just perked up when they heard there was a vacancy on the board. So Diana, tell me a little bit about Brookings Homeless Task Force, soon to become Brookings Core Response.
All right, so the Brookings Core Response, after this weekend, we'll be changing our name over and dropping the Brookings Homeless Task Force. And this kind of came from an idea I had in 2017 while I was living in Medford and I was working at All Care Health. So I was beginning to see, as I was working over there and volunteering in various other organizations, you know, I began to see kind of how some of our organizations and our social services and medical resources in Brookings had, you know, some barriers to access for people. And originally, I began planning this because of the needs that I knew were affecting seniors, and especially those living outside in the rural areas, outside of, you know, the city limits, and that had less access to medical care. So by 2020, you know, our family had moved back to Brookings for almost about a year, and I was still networking and kind of developing what would eventually become Brookings Homeless Task Force. So due to the high needs that we were seeing as a result of COVID and the fires, with people who didn't have access to housing. But our change to Brookings Core Response comes from our need to include all of the people we serve, which is actually community-wide, and not just those without access to housing. So we are all community health workers, so that dictates our scope of practice. And a lot of what we do cultural mediation. So we teach people, or I guess help walk with people and help them learn how to use health and social service systems. All of us have our own lived experience with this, so we are able to come at it from that perspective. And we help the community understand, as well as the people we're working with understand, just sort of the cultural norms and perspectives. So we don't do health education right now, but that is something that we're looking to incorporate in, and something I've been familiar with. So we would like to start doing culturally appropriate health education, like disease prevention and health condition management, and making sure that it's culturally and linguistically appropriate. So if people need it in other languages, or if we do an event, we would have an interpreter there. And also using language that is easy to understand for anybody. And most of it comes from the communities themselves. So it's driven by the people that we're serving. So that also helps. We don't provide case management necessarily. We provide more service navigation. And it is over a period of time. We just don't call it case management. But we do make referrals, and we provide follow-up. So we are working to help address, you know, all the barriers in services. So we're kind of a go-between. If people aren't sure where to find applications or where to get certain services, they can kind of use us as a first stop. And sometimes we follow along with them, and sometimes they just need to kind of bounce off of us to find out where they're going. Mm-hmm. We also do coaching and social support, and we have, you know, we use motivational interviewing as kind of one of our resources, which is helping people come to their own decisions and conclusions, and in order to support behavior change. So we would like to start facilitating community-based support groups. That's something that we're looking to do in the future for anybody, for any kind of issue that comes up. Sometimes it's money management. I know working with seniors, sometimes we help them, assist them with money management and things like that. So advocating, we do a lot of advocating on a macro level, meaning, you know, on a kind of bigger scale. So with local governments or even state governments, we do personal advocation. So we go with people to their appointments. We help them access the resources and go with them to fill out applications or to their appointments, like the DMV or the doctors.
Now, when you say barriers to mm-hmm. access, what are barriers to access?
Well, so right now, most of the barriers that we focus on have to do with COVID, you know, offices being closed. And so people aren't sure where to get information, aren't sure where to, even something, you know, off, you know, we focus a lot on the DMV because the DMV is one that is very widely used by the people we serve. Or needs to be. And so the barriers there currently are that a lot of things you can't just walk in. So a lot of things you have to go online for. And sometimes people don't have access to it, but also sometimes they do, and there's various reasons why they don't. It is overwhelming. Even sometimes for us, you know, with COVID came a lot of changes in how people access things, like unemployment. There were a lot of changes. That's probably the biggest one. We still struggle with unemployment because it's just so hard to get a hold of anybody or to get an answer back and to know what's the next step. So that's one where we, you know, falter in. But barriers to access, you know, traditionally, you know, before COVID, barriers to access meant, you know, people didn't know how to fill out paperwork for doctor's appointments, or didn't know, you know, to get a new doctor, or they didn't know how to change their insurance. It's just like, it's just kind of, there's so many systems that sometimes we just need one place to start. We can bridge the gap by being the obvious person out there, or the obvious entity that's out there, kind of in the way the coalition really is too. You know, when you have a need, it's, in fact, when I first came back here and was looking to start participating, I didn't really get up and start and get out there until March of last year when COVID hit, which is an interesting time to start anything. But when I first started reaching out and asking questions, you know, it was pretty obvious that the coalition kind of was one place to really gather a lot of that, like really network and to really talk to. So Beth was one person I talked to early on. And that's because people know, you know, it's that one point. And so we wanted to also be another point too, and be out on the streets so that it's also easy to access. So that's kind of more what I mean. You know, there are some offices down here, but a lot of our services we get through just access points down here. Like they're managed somewhere else out of our city, or sometimes even out of our county.
Right.
So, yeah.
Now, both of you have at one point or another in your lives been homeless, right? Mm. So, I mean, you actually speak from experience. Beth, you said that you had been homeless at one point, right?
Well, and I'd like to clarify too that everybody has their experience. Every household has their experience. So just because I say I've had an experience with homelessness doesn't mean that I've had your experience or Diana's experience or, you know, any of our clients that we work with. So it doesn't mean that I know how people feel, and I try really hard to avoid that I understand how you feel kind of response to people. And I just really, before I go into my situation, I want to go back to the culturally responsive and the access questions that you were bringing up. Diana brought up culturally responsive, which obviously is two words that are difficult for me to put together, but it doesn't roll off the tongue that easy.
But, say it five times really fast and see what happens.
so part of that also is meeting people where they are. The street outreach that's being done by Brookings Homeless Task Force, now Brookings Core Response. I love that, by the way, Diana. I think that's a great name.
It's a long journey to get to that point. Yeah.
So, because it doesn't pigeonhole you, it puts you in a much broader
category. We're here for the whole community, in the same way I know you are too.
Beth. Right. Yeah. And you know, trust me, I think it was Judge Beeman who, when I first talked to her I think we were at lunch one day with another mutual friend, and she said, "You really need to change your name, the name of your organization." You know, and I'll never forget that day.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it does occur to me on occasion that we have done just that. But anyway, I digress. Meeting people where they are, meeting people on the street is culturally responsive to that population, because the barrier for someone who's homeless could be just walking across the threshold into an office space, or even making a phone call for some people can be a barrier.
Because they're uncomfortable with that.
They're not, and they often haven't made been made to feel welcome when they do access those places. And so, you know, our entry points to healthcare systems or criminal justice or, you know, any of our systems of care, you know, when we talk about having systemic issues, that means that they're within every system that serves our population. There's something that could create a barrier to access and to have people feel uncomfortable about coming into your space and accessing the services that you do provide. So I just wanted to...
It really would have just taken like one bad experience, right? For a person to say, man, I don't ever want to talk to social services again or whatever.
Yeah, that takes me to that's a good segue right into my personal experience. It was very brief and situational. Our situation was caused, my household's homeless situation was caused by a workers' comp. We had one young child, a year old, and her father was injured on the job and to the point where he was in the hospital for 3 weeks and had to have back surgery. He couldn't walk before having back surgery. It was L4-5 crushed discs. And so that was really serious. And we went for 5 months without any income. And I had to go live with my sister-in-law, who was closer to the hospital temporarily, so that I could visit my husband and bring my child to see her daddy in the hospital, which that became a traumatic experience. There were times when she would just throw herself on the floor because she loved to go see her daddy, but she hated to have to be in the hospital room all day. And some of the nurses in the hospital were so cool, they'd come and take her around. And take her for a walk through the hospital and give her a break and give us a break. But it was a very traumatic time in our lives. And we were very young. We were just getting started with our lives. And we were renting a home that was belonged to a friend of ours who was a CHP officer, a friend of the family, a CHP officer in California. And he gave us 5 months. We didn't have any income. It took us that long to get any money coming into the household. And so we weren't able to pay rent. We weren't able to pay bills. We weren't able to buy food. I'll never forget the Christmas that we went to the Salvation Army Christmas gift giveaway. And there were us and 300 other people lined up at the Cal Expo, which was our fairgrounds in Sacramento. Waiting in line with your kids to go pick out Christmas gifts for them, you know, because if not for that, you wouldn't have anything to give for your kids, you know, and we had food stamps that were food stamps. You can get an EBT card.
Right.
We had food stamps, that Monopoly money.
Yep.
So everybody knew that you were on welfare and there was a stigmatism and going into the welfare office. I mean, I can remember sitting in the Sacramento County welfare office with, you know, 50, 60 other people, take your number and it's 100 and something and you're there all day, you know, at least. And so we really, it was a struggle. We were very fortunate to have support from family because we did not have to go unsheltered. We had a camper we were able to live in. But we're talking about 40 years ago, just about.
Yep.
You know, I'm grateful we had family. And I knew that we would not be without shelter at least. But it was, and at the time I didn't consider ourselves to be homeless. We just had to live in a cab over cab, because we didn't have anywhere else to live and we couldn't afford, you know, and it.
Right.
So anyway, our situation lasted for maybe a little over a year before we were able to get on our feet and get into a rental unit again. And so it was brief and it was situational and we did have support. So that's, you know, that's my story. But the trauma that you go through just being treated like and being judged by caseworkers in the welfare office, by people in the grocery store, that's cumulative trauma and it matters and it does impact your thought process, the choices you make. You know, you thrive on instant gratification after a while, because the little things, those little things that you can do for yourself to make yourself feel good for 5 minutes, you know, you may glom onto that, and that might not be the best thing,
right?
The best choice, especially for people outside in looking at the choices that you're making for your family and judging you based on those choices. You don't walk a mile in my shoes before you criticize decisions or judge, you know, or judge decisions or choices that are made, because you don't know where that person is coming from. So,
and that's the really hard part, I think, because, you know, we are really, because we are part of a community, we really care what people think about us. I mean, we just do. We care. And, you know, when they don't think well of us, we start to not think well of ourselves.
It can wear you down over time, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's so, definitely.
But, and I'll say, you know, once I got rehomed and we got settled and got back on our feet and we were able, but again, it was through help from family, and it was not, we weren't able to do it on our own. We had help from family. My mother stepped into the picture and bought a home and then rented it back to us.
Right.
And so we were fortunate to have that, you know, that family support. So, but I'll tell you, once I got out of, you know, out of homelessness and was back stably housed, I was never going to be that person again. I'm better than that. And I would look at other homeless people and say, I figured it out. Why can't you? I was probably one of the worst, most judgmental people when it came to homelessness. And I would give people things like food, if, you know, or what have you, especially if I saw that they had children, but no way was I going to give them cash, because God forbid they should have a choice in what they eat.
And for heaven's sake, if you can pull yourself up by your own bootstraps,
exactly.
Then I know. And it's just, it's crazy.
It took me, honestly, going through a lot of training and working in that vein. Donna Beagle is one of the people, I think I mentioned her last time we were talking, is one of the people who really turned me around. And working at Community Action and really seeing again that we haven't come that far from 40 years ago in terms of our systems of care. And it's almost as bad, if not worse, now than it was then. My experience, I would have thought by now that we could have figured out a more human way to respond to people who are in crisis.
But
a more empathetic way to respond to people who are in crisis, and not, you know, and not layer the response with criticism, judgment,
and fault finding.
So I know I had to take my journey, and I had to come to this in my own time and in my own way. But when I look back at that other person I was ugly.
Mm.
You know, I don't ever want to be that person again. So I work really hard to not be that, not to go into that that space of judgment, but to try to understand.
Thank you,
you know,
for
what everybody
that.
Brings to the party.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that, Beth, because that's you know, that's a hard thing to look at sometimes, where you came from, and you know that you don't want to be that person again who judges. You know, I mean, you want to grow, you want to move on.
I'm a big, you know, I'm going to mess up his name, but I think it's Don Miguel Ruiz, who
has
written many books about self-actualization, self-realization.
Yep. I love this too.
The Four Agreements is one of my very favorites.
Yes.
And if you haven't read it, people need to read.
Yes, I agree.
And follow the Four Agreements, because that's...
Thank you, Beth. And Diana, what about you? What, you know, how did your experience with being on the streets? What was that like for you?
And I'll kind of, you know, specify also that my experience is my own for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely don't, try to speak for anyone. I try really hard not to. It's easy to kind of find my story. I've told my story a lot, and you can you can probably just Google my name and things will pop up. But, you know, essentially, I actually first became homeless, although I did not consider myself homeless. I first became homeless when I was 16. So I moved away from home and moved in with my older sister, who had a place out in Harbor. And, you know, there was just various reasons why I moved away from home. And eventually it just wasn't conducive to me, you know, being productive. I wasn't going to school. I was missing a lot of it. I was struggling in school, which was not something I was used to. When I dropped out with a 3.7 GPA, and that was after it had went down. So I started struggling and sort of at one point didn't feel that I could continue going on. So I dropped out. You know, Matt and I had met before, a year before, and we got reconnected. I ended up moving in with him and his parents. You know, we got our own place. We had our own place for a long time. And then at some point, we started struggling financially. It was shortly after we had my daughter. We moved to Ashland and did really well over there for about a year. And then we decided to move back. And once we moved back, we sort of hit a wall. There was really not a lot to rent. So this would have been, you know, looking back now, I can see how we had a housing shortage, or we had a lot of developers that weren't working during that time. It was about 2008, 2009. And my own dad, as a cabinet maker, you know, closed down his shop as well. Developers, construction companies, they left town, they left the area and retired. So he retired as well. So when I moved back, there wasn't as much housing as there had been before. It was a little bit more difficult. It felt like things were a little more expensive. We also, you know, obviously had a child. And we just stayed with some family. We, you know, stayed with friends sometimes. We ended up having two more children at the time. So I had Ada first, and then we moved back here. I had Eric and Tad. And after that, we ended up in a 27-foot, I think it was a 22-foot RV, very small. And Tad was just a few months old. So we had three kids, three babies, essentially, and living in this RV way out up Windchuck. And so it was really difficult to do the normal things that we, you know, to make a bottle or to do anything. And eventually we got a bigger RV. Then we, you know, our life started sliding downhill at that point. We had already struggled quite a bit, but we didn't really have a direction we were going. And my husband and I wasn't really in my addiction at that point. I had had some medical issues when I was 18 that caused ongoing pain that I still have today, but I manage it differently. And at the time, you know, we've seen the opioids swing, that pendulum swing multiple times. And at that time, it was sort of swung in my favor, although I wouldn't say that now. And so there was not really an end to the medication that I was being prescribed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it started in the doctor's office over here. And then at some point, you know, we moved. I did start becoming addicted after several years. And Matt was already in his addiction at that point pretty hard. And we were in this trailer with these kids, and it just was going so poorly, and we had to escape, or we felt like we were going to lose everything. So we, you know, we called around to the Valley to figure out where we could go. They certainly didn't say, come over and we'll house you. They just told us what was over there, and we just thought we would have a better chance. Because what we were seeing over here, you know, there was one Christmas. And I know everybody meant well. And so, of course, I don't necessarily blame individual people or anything. I just think this is how we are as a society. But, you know, there was one Christmas where we were in that RV, and there was this huge donation drive to get us Christmas presents. And we were still in the 21 or 22 foot RV at the time. And so it was just these mounds and mounds of presents that were brought over. And it, you know, part of me was excited. There's some presents for the kids and whatnot, but it was really difficult because here we were hardly able to sleep on our own bed because of all these presents. And there was not one that was clothing or diapers or anything I really needed. And I just remember being so depressed after opening everything. Mm-hmm. You know, the kids were happy, and it's not really about that, all of that. It's just that I felt so heartbroken over it for some reason, mm-hmm. that I really needed help. So that was sort of the last straw. And we actually, after that, we were there for a little while longer. And then the next summer, we just packed up everything and in our van, and we moved over to Medford. We were homeless there for a while. That was pretty rough. We lived in our van in the Walmart parking lot for several months in Talent. And what we would do is we would drive to the back of the parking lot and put up our blankets and everything, put all the car seats on top of the van. And it was summer, so it was quite warm. We put all the blankets up in the windows. And then, you know, I was pregnant with our fourth at the time. And so the three kids would sleep in the two of them in their car seats, and one of them would be laid out. And then Matt and I would just sleep in the front seat. We'd just lean it back. And then in the morning, we would get up and drive to the front of Walmart. And we would take turns going in and washing up and going to the bathroom, grab a box of cereal and some milk. We had a little cooler, and then we had a storage. And our storage was about a mile away. So we would drive there, change out our clothes, and, you know, and then we would take our dirty clothes. We'd drive to Ashland and we'd wash them in the creek. And we pretty much did this every day for, I don't know, 3 months maybe. Hmm. And it might have been a little bit longer than that. And then we got some assistance to get into a house in Ashland. And I remember driving by that Walmart like 2 weeks later and it was closed. They closed it down. And I drove by and I just started crying because I thought, you know, what would have happened to us if that had closed down while we were still living there? Where would we have went? And that's really sad when you have to think about, like, where would I have lived if Walmart had closed down? You know,
it is very sad.
Yeah.
No, it is. So, it's very sad. Yeah, exactly.
And we got into a place, you know, we were not doing well. I started getting actually like more into my addiction at that point. We didn't have a lot of social support. So that's one thing that really makes a difference for people. When we went to treatment, there were a lot of people in there that did have a pretty good social support system. You know, you can't really go anywhere. Well, you can't go anywhere without what's called a safety person. They have a background check. They go through all this process so that they're, you know, specifically your safety person. And Matt and I were, I think, the only ones in treatment at that time that didn't have a safety person. So that really speaks to the lack of support that we had. And that happens when you have to leave the area where you're from. And so that's why it took us so long actually to get into treatment, is because we didn't have that social support. In fact, when I went to have Noah, there was a woman working at the Peace House. Her name was Ruth. And if anybody's been homeless in Ashland, they know what the Peace House is. They do Uncle Food's Diner every Tuesday, and it's a free meal, and it's really great. They provide a lot of services. But Ruth just sort of took us on, and when I went to have Noah, she watched the other kids so that Matt could be there for his birth. And when we, you know, sorry, I didn't really finish the story, I suppose. We did get into housing. It didn't work out very well. And several months later, because we didn't have any support, we ended up back on the street. We were in our van. We were in our tent for a while. We were in our tent for several months. And we just had Noah. So he was just a couple months old. So we had four kids under the age of five in a tent at Jackson Wellsprings for a couple months. And it was during the rainy season. So it kind of sucked. I mean, if you have kids at all, you know, they need room to run, and sitting in a tent while it's raining outside is not ideal. with one blanket for everybody, you know. And I remember one time Matt making macaroni and cheese over a fire while we were all huddled in the tent and it was raining, and just thinking of how miserable we were. And, you know, I had really spiraled in my addiction at that point and was using, you know, at that point, my doctor, you know, the pendulum kind of swung the other way and my doctor stopped writing my prescription. So I turned to the street because, you know, it's not like I was ready or had the support I needed to stop. I know people told me to stop, but that didn't mean anything because they didn't really understand what I was going through. And so it wasn't as easy as you have to have someone. So, you know, we really spiraled. I got me and the kids, our van had broken down. So I got us a bus ticket back here to Brookings. My parents live here. And I thought, we're going to lose everything. We're going to lose the kids. And so we left, and Matt came a couple days later after he got everything cleaned up. And I thought we would be okay over here. You know, we wouldn't be near the people we were using with. But when we got here, I didn't leave my want to use in Jackson County. That came with me. That came in my head. So instead, I was just here with nothing and no resources and my addiction. So I, you know, at that point, I turned to meth, which I had never used before. And I only used it a couple times, but it was very scary. And, you know, I had been using other things, heroin and cocaine and whatnot. And so I really just dove. We were over here for 2 weeks, and I just dove headfirst into the worst parts of my addiction. So we left again. There's actually a pastor at the church on Fifth Street, Pastor Lance, and he got us a motel room. There was one night we were walking around with all the kids and two suitcases, because that's all we owned. And it was like 9 o'clock at night. We didn't know what we were going to do. So we got a hold of him, and he got us a motel room for the night and a bus ticket for the next morning. And we went back to Medford, and we ended up getting into treatment pretty shortly after. So that really saved us.
It's amazing when you listen to stories like this, right? Because I look at you now and I think, wow, you know, you are a dynamic, amazing, intelligent woman who has gotten it together. And Beth, you are a dynamic, intelligent, amazing woman that has gotten it together. And you're both working for the people who need you the most. And it really is, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? You know?
Yeah, because we were these people before.
Yes,
we just went in the wrong, you know, I don't know if you call it the wrong direction. I would make so many different decisions if I had to go back and do it again.
Of
because I would want to spare my kids that trauma that they went through. And they did. You know, they did. My daughter's old enough to remember these things. And my son is kind of too, so.
But I think that realistically, every one of us can say the same thing. That,
oh, sure.
That we all make stupid decisions, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes we're lucky, right? And sometimes we're lucky enough to survive them.
Or we're privileged enough to have something to fall back on.
Exactly.
Which
exactly.
is, you know, is exactly. not something to overlook for sure.
No, it's not. And I think that, you know, that keeps getting brought home to me by the attitudes that the people who have never had to deal with being unsheltered kind of exhibit, you know, the kind of, you know, basically not understanding what the issues are and kind of going forward with assumptions that, you know, are not, they're not adequate. They're not correct. And yeah. sometimes it can get very, very discouraging. I just wanted to touch on a couple of the things that happened this past week. Because it has been a very, It's been one of those weeks where you just kind of go, wow, how many more things, right? It started out for me with the Monday night city council meeting where Project Turnkey was discussed, and I just wanted to clear up some of the misconceptions because there seemed to have been quite a few. Either one of you can kind of take it and go with this.
Well, you know, there definitely was a lot said at that meeting. It felt like a really charged meeting and not conducive kind of to communication. So I'll be grateful when there are more opportunities for communication, for sure, because we really should be relying on people who know the work, do the work, have relevance and experience. And that's what we do in all areas. And that's what we do in everything. You know, with COVID, we lean on medical science and we trust them to guide us in the right direction. Although I do understand that they're is hesitancy to do that. We need to rely on people who are doing that work,
not and who have done the work,
and those who live it and are out there, we need to include them in the process as well. And I know Beth and I try to include people that we're working with in the work we do, them leading the conversation. And so I think that there was an opportunity there for the city council to listen or actively participate in some more of the conversation before that meeting. And I wish some of those questions would have been asked directly to the people who knew the answers. And that doesn't necessarily mean me because.
And Beth, where does it sit now? The whole funding issue and Project Turnkey and...
Well, I'm not surprised, but I am very frustrated and disappointed to announce that the application is not going to move forward into phase two. We are done with Project Turnkey in Curry County or Brookings. We got notice from Oregon Community Foundation yesterday via email, very apologetic and very disappointed, but the truth of the matter is there's a very limited amount of time to spend down these dollars, and the grant says everything has to be finalized, escrow closed by June 30th. And given the distance between those of us supporting the application and those of the community members that do not, that's a bridge too far for the funder to say we can get this done in that time frame. Mm-hmm. We can't begin to do our due diligence when we have such a division at the leadership level now in the city of Brookings. So we're talking about meeting with the Planning Commission and going through, zoning reviews and possibly changing zoning if necessary. And there's just not enough time to complete all of that work between now and June 30th. So,
and there really seems to have been a real misunderstanding about kind of the progress and what the process was, because this was only in the first stage, right? I mean, it was...
It's the second time around, though, because this was originally submitted, let's not forget, back in January, I believe it was, by Rogue Retreat. So that they were following, the original application was right in on schedule, and it was the time lag between the decision of OCF to say no, one agency, one application, and then us stepping up and saying okay, and that time frame was just... that was valuable time that we didn't have to have those conversations with the city and to maybe respond or address concerns that councilors and community members may have had. So,
I think that's probably where the misinformation started stemming, because that's with me, you know, with me holding the torch, but not being the applicant, it was sort of a difficult place to navigate because, you know, while I have some of the information, it's like, you know, when Rogue Retreat submitted the application, at that point, it's not mine to, you know, or actually when they really started taking it on, it's not my place or my point to answer some of those questions. And so while I wanted to give as much information as I could so that we can all make this decision collaboratively, there's some of that that's just not appropriate for me to say because it's just not mine. And mm-hmm. and I don't, while I understand, you know, how Rogue Retreat operates for the most part, there were decisions that weren't even made on their end yet. And so that and the waiting and then hearing back that it couldn't be them and then looking again and then talking with Beth and submitting and then waiting again, that's a lot of time that, you know, while that's unfortunately what happened and it does feel like wasted time. That time in there was just more time that we couldn't share more information because we didn't have it. And so while it felt, I think, to Councillor Alcorn and maybe some of the others that there was information being withheld, it just, there never was an opportunity for that information to develop. And
the information seriously just wasn't there. I mean, it right. wasn't that it wasn't being
and
shared.
And it's still right. It's never going to be there now. And so right. we can't even comment on, we can speculate like, well, we could have done this and we could have done that with it. But mm-hmm. that's really even all it was back then was just speculating. Well, mm-hmm. the project, you know, I'm not saying that Rogue Retreat and that Beth didn't have some pretty serious plans that they were working on, but there was nothing to bring
there was
forward
nothing concrete
at that
right.
point. And it certainly looked, you know, having to change direction, because that was actually the second time we had to change direction, because originally, you know, we were trying to go with NaborWorks Umpqua, but there was a lot of unclear, you know, it wasn't clear. Mm-hmm. So that was actually the second time changing direction. And I'm sure that there was some confusion on that end, but I tried to make it as clear as possible too. And I know Beth was tried to be as clear as she could with, you know, what she was doing. So I do.
It just seems like there's a certain group of people or a certain mindset that when they hear homeless, they see red.
When we say homeless, we're talking about the issue being the person, which is why, you know, Beth and I have had this conversation. That's why we are dropping homeless, not just because mm-hmm. we work with people in housing, but because when we say homeless, we're saying that the issue is the person. But actually, right. you know, with the people we're working with, it's people without access to housing. And so that's not really much of a choice. So it's not so much the people that are the issue, it's the lack of housing and
right.
lack of
So how do we change the verbiage then to just keep making that clear? Do we the lack of housing?
Yeah. People and then whatever the issue, people without access to healthcare, we say that all the time. Right. So we don't say diseased people.
Right.
Right. It's using people first language.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So we should be using people first language when we describe social ilks, because again, it's not the people that are in the, you know, that are struggling. It is the systems that are not responding to the demands in the community is right. really how I see it. We have right. systems.
It's just being accurate, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that are not responsive to the community. So it takes the onus off the individuals and families that are experiencing housing instability.
Yeah.
I think we've seen that all over the place. Since the pandemic, right? That so many of the safety nets that we thought were there.
Yeah.
Well, and I'd like to go back to, and when you were asking the question, Candace, you made the comment that, you know, that when we talk about homeless, some people see red. I think that I was one of those people at one point in time. So I think that I want to make sure that we're creating enough space in this community and with this dialogue to allow people who have these concerns to express them in a way so that we, because I can't respond to a person's concern if I don't know where that's coming from. But if I know where it's coming from, which is sometimes really difficult to sit and listen to, but mm-hmm. when I know where it's mm-hmm. coming from, then I can develop, you know, a response that addresses those concerns that those mm-hmm. folks have, you know, mm-hmm. And maybe we can find some space to have a comfortable dialogue around the issues. And I really believe that we, you know, bringing an unbiased facilitator into this process who has the skill sets to yeah. build the bridges that we need to have these dialogues in our, mm-hmm. in our county and in our cities, that's going to be a much better path forward for our whole community.
Yeah, I agree.
We have to be able to listen to those folks that have the concerns and
really hear them, really hear yes. what they're saying. Yeah.
What I read from, you know, communications from Councillor Schreiber, and what I hear is that there's not support for a low barrier project. But I understand there are others that are coming forward with what would be defined as a high barrier project. And mm-hmm. I say yay to that. Mm-hmm. If there are people who that, you know, that resonates with and it mm-hmm. works for them, we need housing.
That's right.
You know,
something is better than nothing.
I would, I'd like to know more about mm-hmm. these other possible projects that mm-hmm. are kind of percolating in the community, because if there's a way that we can support those projects and it results in getting people off of the streets stably housed in our community, then I'd like to know more about those projects and get behind those projects as well. Absolutely. Because we're a mixed bag.
Yes.
They're yes. not all the same people out there.
Exactly.
So we need to provide a mixed bag of stable housing for folks.
So I hate to be the bearer of bad news. If you look up on your screen, you can see that it says that Tom is telling us that we are nearly out of time. Again, right? So, Beth, I'd like to follow up. Obviously, we've run out of time this time, but let's, on our next interview, let's talk about what some of those, concerns are that, you know, the people who see red, what some of those concerns are, because it would be good, I think, to just bring it up for discussion. You know, here are some of the concerns. And
and honoring people first, it might not be a bad idea to invite someone who has a different lens on to join our conversation.
Yep.
So we can have that dialogue. I don't want to speak for other people.
No, exactly.
I'd like to give them the time.
Yeah. All right. Well, ladies, I am afraid we are out of time, and Tom's just going to turn the microphones off if we don't stop. So we got to stop. I thank you very, very much. And we will do this again, you know, in a week or so. So, you know, thank you. Thank you so much, both of you, for sharing. Thank you. This is Candace Michelle from Our Community.